compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, this is hour two of our three-hour extravaganza known as the Patrick Madrid Show. It's great to have you along. Thank you very much for listening. And whether you're listening on a Relevant Radio station or on the Relevant Radio app, wherever you may be in the world, thank you. And give me a call. You can call me at 888-914-9149. Let's get over to Guadalupe now, listening in Garden Grove, California. Hi, Guadalupe.
Hi, Patrick. I have a question. I was listening earlier when someone called and asked about something that might be supernatural or diabolic. I have a brother, and he, unfortunately, he's really deep in drugs. I think it's actually messed up his mind completely. He's always talking to a witch. He's always, he's talking to himself. It's difficult to be with him, to live with him.
Okay.
My mother lives with him. The thing is that when he's half normal, when he has these windows of normality, he knows a lot about the Catholic Church, and he gives me gifts. He'll give me Catholic books. He'll give me, I took a crucifix from him. It was like, it's like a 3 feet crucifix because the arms were broken. I took it and I repaired it. And he gives me things, and sometimes I just take things from him because I'm afraid that he's going to ruin them. He gives me a lot of stuff, and I'm wondering if when I bring these things home, if because he's so crazy right now, if I'm bringing anything that I shouldn't be bringing home.
Is he? You mentioned something about you mentioned something about him being in contact with witches. Can you explain what you mean by that? I wasn't sure.
He often speaks to what he calls witches. He talks to girls in his room and he says they're witches.
Are these real people or are these figments of his imagination?
No,
or
there's nobody there. There's nobody there.
Okay. So maybe this is a mental illness. Has he been diagnosed with a mental illness?
You know, he's a 50-year-old man, and he does go to the doctors, but when he wants to go, unfortunately, because he lives in my mom's house, my mom basically takes care of him.
Okay. So I guess what I want to find out is, has he ever been diagnosed clinically with, say, autism or a mental illness? Or is it just he acts strange and you don't know why?
Well, we believe it's because of the drugs that he's used all of his life and continues to use when he can. Yeah.
Yeah, that may be the reason. That could easily be the reason. But my first, if you want some advice, my first bit of advice would be see if you can't get him in for a mental health check and see if there is a diagnosis. So it may come back that he's not mentally ill or that he's not autistic. They have ways of measuring these things, and that would be a good first step in ascertaining, is this something that's, you know, is it organic? Is this physiological or psychological? I would want to know whether or not there is a problem like that, partly, of course, so that it can be treated and he can get some help that way. But then also so that if they say, nope, he's physically and mentally competent, then you can begin to say, well, is it possible that it's something diabolical? Is he being harassed or oppressed or something worse even by the evil one?
Uh-huh.
But as I was saying to an earlier caller, I think it's in your best interest and his to see if there's a natural explanation for this first. So that would be my recommendation for a first step. See if you can't get him evaluated.
Well,
okay.
We have tried and we have taken him, and he does get pills, and but like I said, he's a 50-year-old man and he lives with my mother. And,
no, I understand that. I understand that. What I'm saying is, I guess maybe I should ask the question again. Has a doctor or a psychiatrist or psychologist ever diagnosed him as being, for example, autistic? Has he ever gotten a diagnosis? Okay, I would recommend you do that. Of course, I have no say in the matter, but if I were you, I would want to know. I would say, let's go down and let's do some tests and let's figure out if there's something that is diagnosable? Because if they're giving him pills, there must be some diagnosis. If they're not,
yeah,
it would be immoral and probably illegal to dispense prescription medication to somebody if you haven't given him a diagnosis. So see if you can find out what that is. And if there isn't one yet, I would get one. Then if everything checks out and he's normal in that regard, then it may be that you're dealing with something preternatural. It could be diabolical. But I wouldn't leap to that conclusion, first of all. So he may just simply be deranged. And so if he's saying that he's talking to witches, you know, non-existent people in his room, it is possible that there's some diabolical activity, but it's entirely possible that there's not. And it may all be in his head. It may all just be his own imagination. So I don't want to tell you on the radio, yes, your brother is, you know, in the occult, or he's doing strange things, and you shouldn't keep these gifts that he gives you. This sounds to me as though he's mentally disturbed, and that may be all it is.
And we believe it's the drugs that he's used all for 30
Fair
or
enough.
Some years. You know,
fair enough. But there are ways to treat that, though. I mean, there are medical and psychiatric ways to treat people who are in that situation.
But
I guess what I'm trying to say here is, if I may, what I'm trying to say here is don't leap to the conclusion that this is necessarily a diabolical activity going on. It's possible that it is. It might be. But in order to figure out what's going on, my sense is that that's the first best step, is to see if you can get some psychiatric evaluation. Then you will know, okay, this isn't autism, or this isn't a mental illness. What's the next possibility? And then you begin working on that. That's what I'm trying to say.
Okay. Yeah, it's really hard to get him into the doctors to begin with, and it's really hard to get him to tell us and share with us. And is this something that we can do without his, you know, him pushing his rights on us? I mean,
I believe so. I don't know what the law entails, so I can't help you on that score. But there are people that you can talk to maybe at the county level and find out what are the county programs available for people who are exhibiting signs of mental illness. And I'm certain that there are ways in which you can legally have somebody brought in for an evaluation, even if he or she doesn't want that done, so that they can find out if there's something there. But the legalities of it, or the procedures, I don't know. I think that's something you'd have to take up with the county and see what they tell you.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate
You're welcome.
Yeah, this information.
You're welcome.
Okay,
and then how about this? Once you know, once they've given a determination and an evaluation, then if you'd like to call me back, maybe we can look at the next possibility. If they say that he's fine, then we start looking at the other possibilities. Okay. I don't want you to feel like I'm closing the door on you, because this is important.
No, I don't feel that. Thank you so much, and thank you for all that you do. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Thank you. 888-914-9149. Not to put too fine a point on it, everybody, but just as a reminder, yes, there are times when the evil one will you know, kick up some dust and cause problems, and that is the explanation for some phenomena, that's for sure. But not always. So as a well-balanced approach, it seems to me that you want to start eliminating other possibilities before zeroing in on that one. Let's go to Jesse now, listening in Sacramento. Hello, Jesse.
Hi, Patrick. My question was, if God said in Exodus chapter 19, chapter 20, I'm sorry, and verse 4, I am a God of jealousy or something like that, and then it's a sin to be jealous of, like, yeah, to sin to be jealous.
Yes.
So why does he say that?
I understand exactly what you're wondering about. So there in Exodus chapter 20, he says, "For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God." And what he's referring to there is that those who worship other gods, false gods, besides the Lord, when he says that he's jealous, it doesn't mean the same thing as the jealousy that would be sinful if you were jealous of one of your friends. And the difference is this. Jealousy in the sinful sense means that you want something that doesn't belong to you. You want something that somebody else has, and you have no right to it, but you want it anyway. Like if your friend had a new, I don't know, do you like to skateboard? Do you like video games? Let's say that your friend had a brand new skateboard. Okay, video games. So let's say your friend got a brand new game system, and you don't have a brand new game system. You have an older game system. And if you were jealous of him and you were angry, well, he has that game system and I don't, and I want that game system, that would be a sinful form of jealousy because that doesn't belong to you and you don't have a right to what he has. But this is not what God means when he says he's jealous. It's a way of explaining that God does have a right to our worship. So he has the right, being God, for all of us to acknowledge him as God and to worship him. So he's using the term jealous in that sense. It's not the same as sinful jealousy for that reason. Do you see the distinction between the two? Do you see the difference between the two?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So that's what he's referring to. It's a way of saying don't be going after all other gods, false gods, whether they're statues or money or game systems in video games or whatever it may be. God wants us to put him first. And he means it in that sense. Because he has a right to that.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Does that clear it up for you?
Yeah.
Okay. And how
Thank
old
you.
Are you? You're welcome.
11.
11. So that means you must be, let me guess, are you in 6th grade or 7th grade? 6th grade, right?
5th.
5th grade, okay. Well, this is good. I'm glad you called. If your mom's there, tell her that I said thank you for letting you call me.
Okay, thank you.
You got it. Thank you. Let's go now to Myra in Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Myra.
Hi, Patrick. So this morning, I was cheating on you listening to the Catholic channel on Sirius XM. They were discussing, I know, so sorry. They were discussing Mary's sinlessness and at her conception for obvious reasons. They later went on and were discussing that Mary was tempted by sin, but because she was full of grace, she never acted on her temptation. That confused me. My understanding is that prior to original sin, our will, our intellect, and our feelings were all ordered towards God. So I guess my previous understanding was that without original sin, Mary shouldn't be tempted. So I just wanted your thoughts and opinions on that statement.
Certainly. Well, not having heard what was said, I can't comment on that directly. So I'll just speak in the abstract based upon the question that you're asking about this issue.
Right.
The word tempt as a verb or temptation as a noun can be understood in two different ways. One would be, well, let me just describe it this way. So we hear about in the Gospels, Jesus being tempted in the desert. So the devil is trying to tempt him. In this context, and I would say that the context of the Blessed Virgin Mary would be the same. In this context, this is an external effort at tempting Jesus, the devil trying to get Jesus to succumb to his temptations, you know, worship me and perform miracles, you know, turn these stones into bread, that kind of thing. So there were ways in which he was trying to tempt Jesus to commit a sin. Now, Jesus, in the other sense of temptation, was never tempted in this sense, meaning that Jesus never for a moment stopped and thought about this and said, yeah, I know that would be a sin and that would go against God's plan, and I'm really tempted to do that, and I might want to do that, but no, I'm not going to do that. Jesus was not tempted in that sense. Jesus didn't, nor did Mary, ever face a situation in which it was possible to fall into a sin and stop and pause and think about it, and you know how you kind of imagine in your mind what it would be like if you committed this sin, and you imagine what the pleasure might be from this sin, whatever it is. They never were tempted in that sense.
The angel and the devil.
So in the internal sense, where you are feeling tempted and you are thinking about the temptation and you're evaluating it and imagining it, and then you decide, no, they were not tempted in that sense. Because let's begin with Jesus, and the same is true for Mary, but in a subordinate way. But Jesus being God, of course, and having a human nature perfectly united with his divine nature, his human nature, and that would include his human will, his human mind, etc., these were perfectly ordered toward his divinity. So there was never an instant from the time of his conception that Christ as a man ever sought or considered doing something contrary to the will of God. His will was always perfectly ordered toward doing the will of God. And the same is true of Mary because of her preservation from all sin. So from the moment of her conception, she too was imbued with grace and was preserved. This is a special protection given to her, preserved and kept free from all sin. So any external temptations that might come in her direction, people trying to tempt her, that's one thing. But it certainly is not true that Our Lady in her own mind was deliberating on whether or not maybe she might commit a sin and then decide not to. So in that sense of temptation, no. She never...
I get it.
She never experienced it the way you and I do, you know.
Yes, that's very helpful. So I guess what I'm hearing you say is there was sin around her, but she never experienced that angel on your shoulder, devil on your shoulder, back and forth dialogue. It was just around her because she was human. That makes sense. Thank you.
It's a good way to put it. You're welcome. Okay. Well, I'm glad we could sort that out, and I appreciate the call. I always love talking about these theological issues, and I'm glad you called me today. Thank you for that, Mary. Or Myra,
thank
I'm sorry.
I
didn't mean to call
answer.
You Mary.
Bye.
You're most welcome. Thank you. Yeah, when you talk about Our Lady, obviously, we're talking about a fellow human being. She's a creature. She's not God, obviously. And it sounds crazy to even have to say that, but maybe for some people, we need to emphasize that. She's a creature. She's the highest of human creatures. She's the single greatest human person in all of history. You may say, what about Jesus? Well, Jesus is a divine person who united a human nature to himself in the incarnation. So where it says in John chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, referring to the second person of the Trinity. And then in verse 14, it says, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Keep in mind that Jesus, as God and man, is a divine person who has both, obviously, his divine nature, but he also has a human nature as well. And everything proper to a human nature, Christ has. So he has a human will, he has a human mind, human intellect, human body, all the things that are associated with humanity, the Lord has. But as the Bible says, he's like us in all things except sin. So in the case of Our Lady, she is a human person with a human nature. And that's a very important distinction to remember when it comes to thinking about her and thinking about Jesus. The Son who was born to her is the Son of God because as a person, he is God, the second person of the Blessed Trinity. Mary is a human person, but it's interesting to remember, and I believe important to remember, that the Catholic Church asserts the truth that the single greatest human person in all of history is a woman, not a man. It's a woman. And all the things that derive from that are very important as well. Let's take a break, and we'll come back with more of your calls. We just had a line open up just now, so if you've been getting a busy signal, you can call this number, 888-914-9149. You're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
Oh, Merry Christmas time. Come and find.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
I hope you have a good one.
Good choice, Cyrus. I always love the Tom Petty stuff.
Yep, same.
I've got some good news. You ready for some good news, Cyrus?
I love good news.
I've got some great news. Here it goes. The New York Post is reporting that Congress has dropped the requirement that women register for the draft from the final version of the annual defense bill, which was unveiled yesterday. And we've been talking about this, and I've been voicing my displeasure and my opposition to any measure that would make women eligible for the draft. And I've given my reasons. I don't have to go back through them. But I'm happy to say that the omission of the provision is a win. It has been dropped. Politico first reported that the language would be dropped from the bill. The language requiring women to register for the draft was included in an initial version of the bill that had passed the House in September. A lot of pushback against it, primarily from conservative folk. Calls for all genders. I think what they really mean to say is both sexes, because there are not more than two genders. I'm going to correct it as I go here. Calls for both sexes are to be included in the draft did gain some traction and have been gaining ground since 2015 when combat roles became open to women. Under the current policy, only men between the ages of 18 and 25 are required to register for the draft, which has not been instituted since 1973. The House is expected to hold a vote on the final version of the defense bill later Tuesday evening. So that would have been last night, and I do not have the result of that vote. But I can tell you that the language was dropped, and I was very happy to see that.
So excellent.
That's some good news. Yeah, I like that. That's great news, if you ask me. The number is 888-914-9149. Why don't we go to Franklin in Wisconsin? Good morning, Franklin.
Oh, hi. My question is piggybacking on the last
call. I'm sorry. I apologize. I called you Franklin. It's Roz. My mistake, Roz. Roz in
That's okay.
Franklin.
Sure.
My mistake. Okay.
Yep. My question is, okay, I understand from the last question, Mary created without original sin, therefore she would not contemplate a temptation. But Adam and Eve in the beginning were also created without original sin. So why were they able to contemplate a temptation and make a choice for sin?
Excellent question. The distinction is that Mary was, from the moment of her conception, preserved in grace, and Adam and Eve were not. So Adam and Eve before the fall, they had the right relationship with God, meaning that they had original innocence. But they did not yet, having not passed the test, they were not confirmed in grace. So this is why they could make the choice that they made. This is why they could consider and think about, maybe I will commit this sin and then do it. In the case of Mary, she was confirmed in grace. And to use another parallel here, so just as Adam and Eve before the fall were capable of thinking about committing a sin, and in their case, actually doing it, it's the same with the angels before the fall. So the angels in their original state were in a state similar to Adam and Eve. They didn't have the beatific vision. They were not confirmed in grace. They were in original innocence. But when they failed the test, those who failed, they were instantaneously fallen angels, and they lost all of those gifts that the good angels have. And the good angels at that point were confirmed in grace and entered into the beatific vision. Prior to their decision, they were not in that state, nor were Adam and Eve. But Mary was from the very beginning. So from the very moment of her conception, Mary had the human equivalent of what the angels received when they passed the test and entered into the beatific vision. Mary was not in the beatific vision, at least not in the ultimate sense. But she had this preservation from grace, this immunity from sin, preservation in grace, rather, and immunity from sin. Adam and Eve did not have that, and the angels before the fall did not have that. That's why they could do what they did, and Mary would not have done that.
Okay, I understand that. Thank you. That's very clear.
I'm glad I can help. Thank you, Roz. And again, sorry for calling you Franklin. I read the screen wrong. Let's see. Let's go to Jonathan now. In Farmington, New Mexico. I've been to Farmington several times. I can picture it.
Hi. Yeah. Hi, Patrick. I just had a quick question. I work 60, 70, 80 hours a week. And if I made every attempt to fulfill my holy day of obligation and I missed it because of work, do I still need to go to confession for that?
It would depend on why you missed it. So if you have lots and lots of sweet overtime and you're making tons of money because of the overtime, and you put that above getting to Mass on Sunday or a holy day of obligation, if you could go but you choose to take the overtime instead, then yeah, that would be committing a sin, because you have the opportunity to go to Mass, but you put something else in place of God in that instance. That would be something sinful. But if you're, let's say, an OBGYN and you're on call and today's a holy day of obligation, but you have to be in the hospital delivering babies, your obligation to attend Mass on a holy day is dispensed. So it depends on the circumstances, and it depends upon your intention in the situation.
Sure. Okay, I really appreciate it.
You got it. And today, by the way, is a holy day of obligation.
I know.
I hope you can get to Mass.
Thank you.
Well, here's the thing. Could you ask your employer, hey, listen, today's an important holy day in my religion, and I'll need an hour and a half to get to Mass at lunchtime. Can I take the time off? Have you tried that route to see if they would let you go?
I have not, no. But should be brought up. Yes, sir.
Absolutely. So ultimately, just to repeat myself for the benefit of those listening, if you have it within your power to go to Mass and you don't go to Mass, that would be a sin. And I'm talking about Sundays or holy days of obligation. If it's entirely outside of your power and you have no say in the matter, or just the circumstances being what they are prevent you from getting to Mass whether you want to go or not, then you're dispensed. So it comes down to that kind of thing. But I know that many people that say, yeah, holy day of obligation, I'm busy today, you know, I'm not going to go. This is a holy day of obligation. So just for a bit of extra emphasis, these things are important. And I'll leave you, Jonathan, but also everybody listening, remember this. Jesus said, if you are faithful in little things, you will be faithful in big things. If you are unfaithful in little things, you will be unfaithful in big things. And I think what he meant can be seen in things like holy days of obligation or fasting for 1 hour at the minimum from food and liquid before you receive Holy Communion. It's not fasting for 1 hour before Mass starts. It's fasting for 1 hour before receiving Holy Communion. That in itself is an extremely easy thing to do, because basically 45 minutes go by before you receive Holy Communion, typically at a Sunday Mass. So the church says it's a little thing, but it's something the church requires. And so whether it's a holy day of obligation or fasting from food and liquid before, and that includes coffee, by the way, doesn't include medicine and it doesn't include water, but it does include coffee or, you know, Gatorade or anything like that. But the point is this a little thing? In the big picture, yes, it's a little thing. But don't forget what Jesus said. If you're faithful in little things, you'll be faithful in big things. If you're unfaithful in little things, you just blow it off. No big deal. I'm not going to go to Mass today. I'm not going to, I'm going to eat a donut on the way to Mass, that kind of thing. If you're unfaithful in those little things, Jesus says you're going to fall when the big temptations come. But on the other hand, if you have a regular, consistent practice of fidelity and the little details that might seem insignificant, that prepares you so that when something big comes along, your default position is going to be fidelity. That's what he means. 888-914. Yes, Cyrus.
Yeah, I have a question. So say you're in Jonathan's shoes and you don't have time, or you missed out on calling Patrick Madrid to ask if you have committed a sin or not. Is it okay to confess something that might not be a sin? Or is that wasting the priest's time?
Yes, that's a good question, Cyrus. No, it's not wasting the priest's time. Not at all. In fact, I must admit that there are times when I get irked when I hear people tell me, yeah, the priest told me in confession, stop wasting my time. If you don't have any mortal sins, you shouldn't be in confession. That is so not true. Confession can be for mortal sins and is necessary for somebody who's fallen into mortal sin. It's necessary to go to confession to get right with God and then to receive Holy Communion. But to your point, Cyrus, there's something also known as a devotional confession. It's the same sacrament. There's nothing different, but one does not have to have any mortal sin. In fact, there are people who live such holy lives of rectitude that for them, the sins that they might discern in themselves are very minor by comparison, and it's still encouraged to go to confession as often as you can. And that way, you are strengthened by the graces. So to your question, Cyrus, if somebody says, you know, I missed Mass, I'm not sure if it was my own fault, I may have had the opportunity to do it, I'm not really sure, honestly, it's always a good idea to bring those things up in confession. That way you can just wipe it from your mind and you won't be worried about it. You won't be thinking about it and saying, gee, I wonder if I've committed a sin. Just leave it there at the foot of the cross and it's done. And if it was sinful, you're forgiven. If it wasn't sinful, you don't have to worry about it.
Thank you. That's really helpful. I love it. Thank you.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I'm glad you raised the question because there are many people who they're not entirely sure. And it's always a safe rule of thumb to bring it up. If it's nagging at your conscience, if there's something bothering you and nagging at you, that's usually a sign that there's something wrong. So even if you don't have a precise understanding of exactly what is wrong, that nagging of conscience is a good thing to heed and bring up that issue. Father, I don't really know if this was a sin, but my conscience is bothering me about it. Here's what happened. You tell him what happened. He may say, yeah, that was a sin. Or he may say, no, that wasn't a sin. And either way, you know that you've been honest with God and yourself. You've brought it up, and then it's forever in the past. Isn't our God a merciful God that he gives us so many second chances? Boy, if it weren't for second chances, where would we be, huh? 888-914-9149. Why don't we take a quick time out and we'll come back with more of your phone calls. We now have two lines open. You can call and grab one, 888-914-9149. We'll come right back to your phone calls right after this.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. You can join the conversation by calling 888-914-9149.
Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and RelevantRadio.com.
I want you for Christmas. I need you.
I haven't heard this one before.
Do you know who this is?
Well, it's not Cheap Trick.
It is.
You're kidding me. They did a Christmas version?
They did. Yep. How funny.
I've never heard that before. All right. I like the original better.
Yeah, no doubt. But it's fun, you know. Played a couple times.
Hey, question. Did you see the, how would you describe it? Did you see this picture? It was a painting of Mary holding Jesus after his crucifixion, after his death. It's a tradition, you know, it was intended to be like a traditional Catholic piece of art. Mary and Jesus are both black in this picture. It was displayed at Catholic University of America, and it was in their law school. And I saw it on social media several times without realizing what it was. And I thought, you know, this is beautiful. I like this. I like the way this looks. It's a depiction of an African version of Mary and Jesus. But my first instinct was to say this is beautiful art. I didn't realize that there was a controversy associated with this. This came out, I think it was about a week ago. It was actually intended to be a representation of the likeness of George Floyd, who was killed by the police officers in Minneapolis, as we all know. And the hullabaloo not only surrounding this was that some people were outraged that it was that Jesus was painted in the likeness of George Floyd. And I didn't see that. And I went back and I looked at it. It still didn't look like George Floyd to me. I didn't recognize that this was supposed to be him. So my first reactions every time I saw it was, you know, that's really striking. That's really beautiful. I like this. Only later did I discover, a day or so later, that not only was there controversy because the artist, and the artist, by the way, is Kelly Lattimore, said that this was intended to portray Jesus in the form of George Floyd. So that was controversial. But also that it got stolen. So somebody stole this piece of art. The painting is called Mama by St. Louis artist Kelly Lattimore. It shows a black Virgin Mary cradling Jesus' dead body after his crucifixion in a style known as the Pietà. This, by the way, is reported by Religion News last week. It was discovered missing last Wednesday. This is, was it last Wednesday or maybe the Wednesday before? It had been placed outside Washington Law School in Mary Mirror of Justice Chapel. And after it was stolen, a smaller version of the same painting was its replacement. Lattimore said his depiction has drawn criticism ever since he created it last year, but things escalated after the Daily Signal, which is a conservative website, published a story about the painting, an online petition purportedly written by Catholic University of America students advocating for the painting's removal began circulating, as well as accruing more than 3,600 signatures. Now, this is as of 2 weeks ago. Lattimore told the Religion News Service that death threats against him have increased. I think, unfortunately, racism is part of a lot of it, especially death threats that include derogatory remarks about George Floyd specifically, he said, adding that some of the threats took issue with any depiction of Jesus as black. So the rest of the article is, as you might imagine, from the Religion News Service, which is very leftist, is all about like white supremacy. And I personally, I have no way of knowing whether Mr. Lattimore is telling the truth and whether or not he actually received death threats. I find it hard to believe that he would. But then again, some people are crazy, and there are people who might do that kind of thing. But for what it's worth, my reaction was very positive when I saw it and then saw it again and then saw it again. I just thought this is a beautiful piece of art. I didn't see George Floyd in this, but once I discovered that this is what was the intent behind the painter, I don't share the views of those who were against it or who stole it. I would, you know, obviously denounce that. It's not their property. You don't have a right to steal that. I can understand why people could object to, why are you turning Jesus into George Floyd? George Floyd isn't Jesus, and Jesus isn't George Floyd. Jesus isn't Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King isn't Jesus. And you could go on down the list of, regardless of the race, you could go on down the list of saying there is a certain inappropriateness of using the image of Jesus and Mary to further a political point. And for many people, there is a political dimension to the George Floyd. And I'm talking about people on both sides of the issue. There is a political dimension, a political component to George Floyd's, you know, posthumous presence in our society nowadays. And so to use the image of somebody who has been murdered or some other public figure, he's now a public figure, it does have an element of, in my view, it's a way to make a political point by exploiting a sacred image. And there's so much that could be said about this. But my point simply was, I just thought it was a piece of beautiful art. And I don't countenance, I certainly would condemn people stealing that. I condemn people making death threats. How ridiculous. Why on earth would any sane person threaten to kill somebody because he disagrees with that person's political position? It's stupid. It's wrong. And if it was racially motivated, so much the worse. But I just wanted to acknowledge this because it was a story, a big story in some circles, in the not too distant past, and I didn't have an opportunity to mention it before, so I wanted to just mention it to you now. I personally like representations of Jesus and Mary that are reflective of the culture in which they're made. So whether it's in Asia, where you see a Chinese-looking Mary, a Chinese-looking Jesus, or in Africa, or wherever it may be, I think that that has a rightful place in Christian art, and it's a good thing because it's a way of showing not only our love for Jesus and Mary, but it also shows the solidarity that Jesus and Mary have with us in our own cultures. One way to look at that would be to see how the Blessed Virgin Mary historically will appear, when she appears, in the form and in the likeness often, and speaking the language of the people to whom she appears in their culture. So we talked earlier today about the miraculous image of Our Lady of Guadalupe. She appeared in that form of an Aztec noblewoman. So she was arrayed in the garments and her skin color and her hair and her entire appearance, she appeared as an indigenous woman. And that's beautiful. Now, Mary is not a an indigenous woman. She's not a Mesoamerican indigenous woman. Mary is not black. Mary is not white European. Whatever facial and other characteristics Mary had during her earthly lifetime, we won't know what those are till we get to heaven. But there's nothing wrong with depicting Mary, or Jesus for that matter, according to the manner of the people in a given locality. The church has always seen that as a good thing, and I myself say it's a very good thing. But when something is politicized, I could see that's where it becomes controversial. And controversy for its own sake is not a good thing. If something is valid in its own sake, in its own right, and it becomes controversial, well, these things happen. And we have to deal with them as they actually are. And we have to evaluate things on their own merits. So once again, if you Google this, Pieta, P-I-E-T-A, George Floyd, you'll see what I saw, and that is a beautiful piece of artwork that happened to be politicized. 888-914-9149. How about Mark in East Norriton, Pennsylvania? Hi, Mark.
Hi, Patrick. I've been playing the $7 for a while now, and I'm having a tough time reconciling the one of the mysteries, well, not the mysteries, but for comparison purposes, when you think of the loss of the child Jesus, that happens before they find Jesus in the temple. What happens right. first, the prophecy of Simeon or the presentation of the temple?
Well, the presentation of the temple, when that took place, this is 40 days after the birth of Jesus. This was for the ritual expiation of sin. Now, Mary did not have any sin. It was an obedience to the Mosaic law, which prescribed that women, 40 days after childbirth, concluded their time of ritual impurity. And this involved the shedding of blood through childbirth. And so at the presentation in the temple, when Mary, you notice that in the passage it talks about they offered this sacrifice of two turtle doves. That was the prescribed sacrifice at the end of this period of ritual impurity. And she was not impure. So this was a ritual impurity that was understood in the Mosaic law that did not, strictly speaking, apply to Mary. But when they presented Jesus in the temple, that's when the prophetess Anna and the prophet Simeon made their prophecies over Jesus. And you know that Simeon says, "Nunc dimittis, Domine, now you may dismiss your servant, O Lord." And so it took place at the same time when they went up to Jerusalem and they went to the temple. That's when they presented Jesus in the temple.
Okay, so it did happen at the same time. I just want to know which happened first, because I'm trying to think of Mary as when she's going through that ordeal, and you know, it's very easy to picture her with losing the child Jesus and going back to Jerusalem and spending a day or two or three finding them, because I think she traveled for a day, so it took a day to get back and then maybe 2 days to find them. But so I'm trying to like picture what happened first. Did she meet up with Simeon and Anna before the presentation or after?
Oh, 12 years before. 12 years before. So the presentation in the temple and the prophecy of Simeon took place 12 years before the finding in the temple.
Oh,
so
wow.
They found Jesus in the temple when he was a lad of 12 years old.
Well, I understand that. So I'm comparing the yes, okay. I understand that. But so okay. I'm comparing the seven sorrows compared to the joyful mysteries. Right, so I get the losing the child Jesus and finding him. Right, so that's
okay.
comparing
that. Okay.
So, but I'm struggling with the prophecy of Simeon as the first. I believe that's the first $7. Right, it's the prophecy of Simeon.
Let's see. Yes, it is listed as the first one. Right.
Yes, compared to the presentation of the Lord, the presentation
right.
of Jesus at the temple, and you just said that they happened at the same time.
Yes,
right.
So at the end of 40 days, when they presented Jesus in the temple, that was when Our Lady and St. Joseph offered that sacrifice of the turtle doves. And that's when, this is Luke chapter 2, that's when Simeon gave his prophecy.
So did the joy happen before the sorrow, or the sorrow happen before the joy?
Well, okay, I'm not sure I'm understanding your question. Maybe I'm misunderstanding it. So in terms of the seven dolors, that refers to Our Lady and her sorrows that she went through. Okay. So Simeon, for his part, he experienced the joy. This is why it's the joyful mystery, the presentation in the temple. That's referring to Simeon's joy, because he's seeing the salvation of Israel, and he's prophesying over Jesus, saying, now, Lord, you can dismiss your servant, because in my joy, I see that this is the fulfillment of your promises. So the joyful mystery is referring to, so the joyful mystery is referring to Simeon's joy. The seven dolors. Yeah. Now, I don't want to close the door on the fact that obviously Mary and the foster father of Jesus, St. Joseph, they too were joyful as they presented Jesus to the Lord as their firstborn, the firstborn that opens the womb. So there was joy on their part there for sure. But it seems to me that the particular joy that we're remembering there is what Simeon expresses in his prophecy.
Okay. But again, it happens at the same time.
Yes.
The presentation and the $7 on the same day within a matter of minutes or hours or whatnot, they happen at the same moment in history.
Yeah. So imagine that Mary and Joseph bring baby Jesus to the temple. And at some point, because it doesn't give us a timeline, doesn't say that they were there for 3 hours or all day, or it doesn't tell us those details. But we know that while they were there and while they were there to offer the sacrifice of the two turtle doves, that they encountered the prophet Simeon. He made this prophecy. He was joyful. Our Lady understood this because of his prophecy, and a sword will pierce your heart, in describing how Jesus would be destined for the rise and fall of many. So she's experiencing the sorrow of knowing what is going to transpire with Jesus. He's experiencing the joy of seeing the fulfillment of the promises to Israel. So the same event contains many, many elements, those two included.
Okay, that's helpful, because I do try to meditate on when I say the seven Hail Marys for the $7. I've just struggled with this one, like what happened first and second, and if this is helpful, and I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome. I'm glad to help. And this is an important question. I wasn't tracking with you at first, so thanks for
I know, it's
clarifying
difficult.
It for me.
I'm a linear person, so I can clearly understand the losing the child Jesus and finding him in the sorrow and the rejoicing. This one, I was like, what happens first? What happens second? I couldn't think of how, and you helped. You definitely helped. I couldn't think of what happened first and second. That's all. Because I knew it was in the same. I believed it was in the same event at the same time in history. Within a day or two, or within could have been within an hour. I don't know, but I couldn't wrap my head around unraveling this. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're most welcome, Mark. And I think I like to imagine these things as well. What must it have been like for Mary and Joseph to bring God Himself into the temple precincts, and knowing that Mary had no need of making an offering for ritual impurity, and yet in humility and docility, they did what God asked of them. And how beautiful it was that Simeon recognized who it was that had been brought to the temple. I love contemplating these things too, Mark, so I'm glad you gave us an opportunity to dig into this one. Thank you. All right, I won't make the mistake I made yesterday and say that it's the end of the show after only 2 hours. I was confused yesterday, but I'm not confused today. We have one more hour to go, and I will be right back with you right after this quick timeout. So please, call me at 888-914-9149. I'll be right back.
Fragile. That must be Italian.